Hello and welcome to Unusual Sources. This is Peter Leibovich on Save FMU 93.3 along with Brendan Stone and Jessica. And on the line we have an old friend of the show, Phil Taylor from the Taylor Report. Hello, Phil, are you there?
Yes, how are you doing?
Not bad. Phil, we know that over the years we've talked to you about this, the trials in Rwanda.
Tanzania.
And Arusha and Tanzania, the Rwanda and the genocide trials there. Mm-hmm. And just recently, last week in Canada, a man called Desiree Munyaneza was convicted under the War Crimes Act that was passed by the Canadian government. Mm-hmm. And part of what he was accused of was genocide. And the reason we called is because we want to be clear on this term genocide and the use of the term genocide, in particular how it relates to Rwanda. Mm-hmm. There was a tribunal, right, that looked into the question of genocide, if it was a planned, pre-planned.
Yeah, conspiracy to commit it and a plan, yes.
Yes, and that case, I mean, it's not very well known here, but the defendants weren't found guilty on that charge,
that's right?
Right.
That was the so-called Military One case. The most prominent figure in the case was a gentleman called Colonel Bagasora. And Bagasora has always been identified, particularly in the Canadian media, as the principal organizer and leader of a planned genocide. The court did not conclude that. And to this date, they actually have not concluded that anybody, they haven't found anybody planned it, and they haven't found a conspiracy, although several people have been accused at various times. But incidentally, this is also largely true of the cases at the of former Yugoslavia, the so-called the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia. There was a great deal of rhetoric, particularly from organizations that specialize in discussing the subject, that they were going to, what was going to be shown and what was known. And it turned out, as often will with trials, that the trial did not demonstrate what people who were sort of in the field claimed was going to happen. By the way, one man was acquitted. His name is Kabaligi. He's a general. And your listeners should know that people came into court and said, Kabaligi was one of them, and he was he took a helicopter with weapons, and he flew to a stadium in Changugu, and he spoke to a rally, and he passed out the guns, and people were slaughtered, and boy, that was terrible. And of course, that would be terrible. The problem was, and there were many witnesses who said it, the problem was that Mr. Kabaligi was not in Rwanda. So I think your listeners, everybody, needs to stop and realize that there are people who have gone into court and told hair-raising stories, and it turns out they must be seriously mistaken, because in this case there was no doubt, because of his passport and his in a confirmed presence in another country, that somebody was not being truthful. That's been a hazard with these courts. But in the case of Kabaligi, I mean, of course, well, he was acquitted. On the conspiracy front, well, no, they haven't shown there was a plan. There's no question that thousands and thousands, and I don't know the number, and definitely nobody else does either, were slaughtered, largely in civilian conflict, by mobs in Rwanda between April and July of 1994. That's not an issue. The question is, did somebody plan to do that? Was it the army? Was it the political leadership? And then, if so, how did they do it? And, well, that we have not got to the bottom of so far.
When people deal with the word genocide now, I mean, it's such a politically charged word, and it's used practically in every major conflict now.
Yeah, indeed. Much too, the the word, the value, the content of that word is being debased, because now practically every political conflict, people involved in the conflict feel they have to invoke it, because that's the maximum insult or crime, or it's the thing that which will inspire people to intervene, or participate, or join the side of the one making the accusation. It's very unfortunate, because we had a pure case, true case of genocide in World War II, carried out with the, based on a political, philosophical theory of the Nazi Party, based on the idea of racial supremacy. And they acted on it, and it was a hideous crime, and it's known to history. What's been going on in many countries of the world, whether it's Sudan, Rwanda, other places, is the word is being invoked, but it doesn't in any way resemble, the reality does not at all match the criteria that you would have if you know what happened during World War II and what the Nazis did. So it's really been, I think, a mistake for people to carelessly throw this word around, because it leads ultimately to great confusion about Nazism and what it was.
And
I should say what it is, because I'm sure there is many exponents still wandering around.
Well, the Nuremberg trials set the definition of a genocide. Now,
but Nuremberg did not address specifically that term. Nuremberg was a trial of war crimes under which genocide, the targeting of ethnic groups, religious groups, whatever, was carried out, and that was identified. But the term genocide was not at that time part of the legal language of that court, of the Nuremberg court, which, by the way, was the most successful of all in terms of getting the facts out and getting the right people in the dock. And it was a court which, I don't know, people think, well, it was a victor's justice, and there's no doubt there's some element of that, but there were a number of people, I shouldn't say a number, but at least four people who were acquitted, who were found not to have participated in the planning and execution of Nazi policies.
But today, the use of the term seems to negate any debate or discussion or analysis of what's happening in these countries. In other words, the evil of genocide is attributed to the indigenous culture. There's something wrong with those people, and as opposed to the geopolitical environment and the different factions and who's supporting who, it takes it out of the realm of political debate and into the good versus evil theories. Yeah. that George Bush used to love to expound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe the word has been debased, it's a fashionable term that everywhere in the world is a conflict. Somebody claims that the conflict involves genocide, and I think if you study it, you get the impression that people invoke that word because they're hoping to cause a response, obviously along the lines that whatever their political prejudice point of view is. It hasn't been enlightening or helpful. I'm not pleased. The Munoz case you referred to, I want to just mention about that. It is not a happy development that if we have a case tried here in Canada and you had no jury and you had the witnesses were all anonymous. And so that the judge says, well, DPK said so-and-so, whereas WHV said so-and-so. And then the quotes are laid there, But if you would know, I mean, here, if we had a case like that involving a murder case in Canada, it would be very troubling when we don't know who, well, who's DVK, et cetera. I mean, and if you say, by the way, well, who is that person? They say, no, we can't tell you that because they were protecting them. Well, that means you're having a kind of a secret trial. And that's a problem because if you go back to General Cabaligi, DVK, WWF, whatever, came into court and said, oh, yeah, I saw him. He did it. He's a horrible man. Yeah, okay. But we found out he wasn't there at all. But you're here saying these things. So, you know, part of a due process is people openly face their accusers. People, you know, have to face the person they are accusing. And the person being accused gets to face them back, and we then have a share in the responsibility of deciding whether we believe one or the other. But when you start having anonymous witnesses, you're tempting people to be less than truthful.
Now, you were involved, you helped with the defense in Arusha. You were doing investigations in the courts in Arusha. Did not the witnesses state who they were? They weren't, or did they use the same methods in Arusha?
It's anonymous witnesses in Arusha, and now that they're bringing these kinds of, they say, well, you know, instead of sending the accused person to Rwanda, and because the ICTR in Arusha does not. The ICTR did not accuse Mr. Munyaneza, for example. They did not charge him. Now, Rwanda had a problem with him, and then Canada said, well, we'll try him. Well, it's very problematic because this is Canada, this is not Rwanda. And then so they imitated the ICTR, which is to, you know, where they, it is now automatic that the witnesses are turned into letters in the alphabet. Not only that, you can't ask about where they worked, who they knew. All that is either going to be done in closed session or not at all. And when I say closed session, that's another problem that goes on in Arusha and elsewhere. Again, we're not having, those are very close. People think they don't like Gitmo and that kind of stuff, but that's where you go when you start this stuff. I was in the courtroom in Arusha, Tanzania, when a man came in, and he said, I'm not anonymous. I want to give my name. I want to testify. I'm not afraid. And so they began his testimony, and then they took a lunch break, and he came back, and he said, I want to ask for protection. It was clear to me that what was going on there was that the prosecution did not want people who were saying they weren't afraid, because if the witness says he's not afraid, that would mean you should actually try to find out if there's any basis for people not saying who they are when they testify. And from that day forward, no, there was never again anybody, at least on the prosecution side, who didn't come anonymous. It's not a proper judicial system when you do that. And it's now in our Canadian courts. Now it's happening here. So we'll see if they can go forward with it. But instead of patting themselves on the back, oh, look, we had a trial, they ought to say, why did we have that kind of trial here?
Yeah, instead, it was sort of like, oh, this is the first test of this War Crimes Act in Canada, and you know, if it's not successful, it somehow it would demean from the War Crimes Act. It was like everybody
It had to be a success.
It had nothing to do with whether the guy was innocent or guilty. There was no question. Nobody was questioning on the facts. It was all about this is it was political theater, and the theater had to have a happy ending for the participants.
It had that element, I believe.
Way all the news sort of approached it. This is a test of our law.
Well, no, I mean, you got headlines out of, you know, how bad he was. And the defense witnesses were utterly discredited by the media, although they wouldn't have any idea who they were. I don't know how you discredit somebody. You don't know them. It was just that they were just letters like the other letters. I agree with the Globe and Mail wrote an editorial about this. They say it doesn't look like we're going down the right road, and they thought it was unfortunate that the judge chose to quote from one of the witnesses a kind of poetic term, which, you know, kind of worrying. He said, well, even if I wasn't here, the wind and the sunlight would carry the message of my message of what happened. And, well, not really. I mean, you're the witness. You either do it or don't do it. But, you know, and for him to quote that, it's like saying, well, then I would take the evidence of the sun and the wind, you know. It just, I think it's not an encouraging sign when you, that this is going on.
And I want to go back to the sort of the political environment that this whole genocide term is being used. I mean, you did say that the court in Arusha could not find any conspiracy to commit genocide. We now, you know, we have a situation where in Sudan the West is calling what's happening in Darfur a genocide.
Yes.
And it seems that they choose to use the term genocide when they are not happy with the government, but refrain from using any term, even if they are, like when the Ethiopians invaded Somalia and there was thousands of people killed there, the term doesn't get used.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it does. I mean, you've spoke on many occasions about the situation in Rwanda. What is never discussed in about Rwanda or Sudan is the causes of the civil war.
Yes.
Why did people find it at each other's throat? Why are they killing each other? I mean, there are reasons. They didn't just wake up one day and decide to kill their neighbors.
It seems to me these tribunals, the function, whether they intended or not, the function is to turn political issues into issues of criminality. So that, for example, somebody started a rebellion in Darfur in 2003. An armed band, pretty big one, attacked an army base, and a lot of people got killed, and it was heavy fighting. And then there was an attempt to defeat that group. Well, Washington and London decided that they would bring criminal accusations against the government instead of saying, okay, well, you have an armed group, you have the government, maybe we can work out a resolution of this, which involves politics and negotiations and et cetera. But no, they said, no, he's a criminal. So he's out of the picture. He has no rights because now we've called him a criminal. He can't function as the president. So you take from him and his side a role in the political resolution of the problem. So that's what you've achieved by starting with this kind of accusation. And of course, a lot of people were shocked, including people very well versed in what was the realities of Sudan. They said, oh, wait a minute. I mean, obviously these people were calling the rebels pretty rough characters, so there needs to be some appreciation that there would be a reason for the government to act against them. A man like Alex DeWall, I think we talked about it before on your program, he's one of the authorities. He said he's very clear, it's not genocide. And he says the people who are trying to say that the Darfur matter is genocide are actually just muddying the issue. They're not helping. And he presents a lot of evidence for his point. And so it's very important. I don't know if people know that the studies have been done now. I mean, in terms of the life expectancy of someone living in Darfur, and it's the same or better than in other regions. That's just a fact. And he can tell one of the reasons is because international aid in the form of medicine and food. Actually, the diet there is a little better than some other places. And Sudan's a poor country. So it has regions where life expectancy is not very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this goes to even a more broader topic of war crimes tribunals and, you know, who gets to prosecute and who gets to charge. Just recently we're seeing, you know, there's two events that have happened recently or one still happening. The Pakistan is attacking the Northwest Territories there and the civil war in Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
The United Nations seems to be calling for investigation of war crimes in Sri Lanka. But it has not uttered a word about war crimes
In Afghanistan or Pakistan. Iraq.
I mean,
they have people like Cheney who boasts of what he is in favor of, and which we know from the photos happened. But no, of course, they can't screw up the courage to bring a big guy with a lot of clout into court. So they say, well, let's pick on a little guy. Well, what kind of sense does that make? We should reject the court, any court that does that. Ramsey Clark often says, you know, equality before the law is the basis of justice. If we have one law for the big and the powerful, and then another law for the small and the poor, that's of course, the jungle. That is not justice. That's a joke. So, yeah, I think that people who are calling for, you know, oh, let's ask the UN to do this and that, and meanwhile, they avert their eyes over what is going on in Afghanistan. I mean, one of the first witnesses you could call in Afghanistan would be the president of the country, who says, I can't protect my own country from the aerial attacks of my so-called allies. I can't protect them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you have a clear double standard. We're waist-deep in hypocrisy. We should be very alert and critical of this. People should not have any illusions about the United Nations even-handedness or the World Court and all that. It's a political process dominated by the Security Council, favoring France, United States, and Britain. They're still the favored. They still get what they want.
Yeah, we just had the example of Israel and Gaza, where they never signed on to the, like the Americans. And when people ask for, war crimes investigations into Israel and their actions in the Gaza, well, the UN said, well, we can't because they haven't signed on to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
of course, by the way, the U.S., of course, has not signed on to anything. And
no,
they've even gone to the trouble to get bilateral agreements, the private, you know, side agreements with states that will work with them not to cooperate with the international tribunal. So why would people be excitedly trying to promote a tribunal which the United States says it doesn't believe in, but go ahead and prosecute somebody from Sudan or go ahead and somebody elsewhere, but meanwhile they don't respect it at all?
By the way, Louis Zarber, the second prosecutor for the War Crimes Tribunal, right?
That's right. She took over from Mr. Goldstone.
Yes. She was asked that question in basically a puff piece because, I mean, she is a saint in Canada now. And she said that that during the trials in Yugoslavia, Serbs were asked her, how come you're prosecuting us and you're not, and you don't prosecute Americans and you don't prosecute the big countries?
Yep.
And her answer was as feeble as they get. They said, "Well, you know, we got to start somewhere. Somewhere. You always start with the victim, or start with the person who lost the war."
Yes. No. Unfortunately, that's a very good story. Very apt. And I'm amazed at people who have law degrees and put their hands on their heart about how much they care about justice, who then end up saying, well, it's not justice exactly, but, you know, it's a start. Well, unfortunately, a start is not accurate, not helpful. And they should be ashamed of themselves, actually.
Well, it goes back to the other question. It stops the what you mentioned. It stops the political discussion. I mean, who knows the names of the groups in Sudan and Darfur and who they're armed by and what's their agenda, what's even their program, and, you know, who supports them, and, you know. I mean, all these kinds of discussions.
Incidentally, they told us last December, I think it might have been January this year, that in November, Israel had attacked a couple of convoys in Sudan, had an aerial attack on them. And they just said, oh, by the way, we did that. Wasn't denied by Israel, and it was agreed that it had happened. We learned of it about 2-3 months afterwards, and nobody said, "Well, that's just that's really not, that's not acceptable behavior. That's an act of war." But it's kind of like when Bill Clinton fired a missile and destroyed the pharmaceutical plant in Khartoum. People just sort of shrugged, and matter of fact, they've all forgotten that he did that. Well, that's a crime, you know. He's not at war with Sudan. He's got no business to it.
And of course, you have people coming across the border all the time who are involved. Like George Bush is going to be speaking in Toronto this Friday night. Yep. And then over a million Iraqis have died as a result of his intervention.
Yes, everybody's going to be focusing on Bush. They forget that Clinton laid the foundation for that. It was the Clinton administration, of course, who took over from Bush Sr., and they had established quite illegally a no-fly zone in over two regions of Iraq. They had, and in enforcement of that, they had regularly attacked Iraqi positions. That was under Bill Clinton. And, of course, Mr. Obama, he's surrounded by Clinton people, the Clintonistas, they call them. There's no change. It's just... some people say, well, good cop, bad cop. I think this is more a case of bad cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, here's a man who now, he says, oh, Bush was wrong to put all the bang-bang in Iraq. We need to transfer some of the bang-bang to Afghanistan. And well, that's more of an adventurous policy than Bush.
Yeah, and expanding it now into Pakistan.
And that permits Mr. Harper to say, see,
mm-hmm.
This is where you want to invest your bang-bang.
Yes. And with increasing, further destabilization of the whole area.
We ought to be very frank with ourselves and appreciate that that's what they have in mind. They're not there to bring stability. They're actually there to bring destability. They're trying to undermine stability. They have something in their minds, which I don't think they're sharing with us.
Yeah, I mean, in this latest go around, I mean, according to the West's own press, over a million internally displaced people in a period of 3 weeks in a nation. That's an amazing amount of people that have been displaced because of a war that seems to be done at the behest of the Americans. They put all the they wanted the Pakistanis to go to war, and now they got them at war.
Yeah,
how's that going to create stability in Pakistan?
It isn't. It's going to permit them to further name more of the leading figures in the region, because as they come in with firepower, they name and establish who will be in power. And by the way, they use leaders kind of like some of the people use a Kleenex. When they're through, it goes in the wastebasket. There's always more.
Yeah, they did that with Musharraf pretty quick, and got Bhutto killed.
When you're used up, they get another guy. But one thing you can assume is that they're going to continue to press. And the stability is not what they're looking for. They're looking for a reason to be there and to exercise hegemony.
And the other thing we can be sure of, they won't be charged with war crimes under the present international law.
No. Ever. It's not going to happen. And so people who say, oh, gee, you got a run-down, bankrupt international court, I want to use that, are idiots. And we have a number of idiots wandering around here who think, oh, boy, it sounds so nice. Well, it does sound nice, but since it doesn't work, let's not use it, okay?
Well, and the people that are funding and running the courts are the same people that are intervening and creating the wars.
Yep.
That's sort of like they got it, you know, they have it on both ends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Phil, by the way, for listeners, we're talking to Phil Taylor from Taylor Report on CIUT on Monday, right, at 89.5?
Monday, 5 o'clock. It's also, I have a website, taylor-report.com, CIUT.com. Just let me tout a book. There's a new book out by Fred Jerome, St. Martin's Press. It's called Einstein on Israel and Zionism, and it's an account of his lifelong involvement with and argument with the State of Israel, and it's a wonderful because it is a collection, very honestly and directly put together, of Einstein's views and involving his letters and everything else. In a nutshell, he said, "I believe in a homeland. I don't believe in a state, and I believe in cooperation with Arabs." It's very, very clear. But I recommend that book, Fred Jerome, Einstein on Zionism and Israel.
We should interview him in this program.
Definitely talk to him.
Okay, we will. So, thanks, Phil. I'm sure we'll talk again pretty soon.
Good.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Phil Taylor from the Taylor Report on CIUT.